An Osho Talk.
God is dead. Now Zen is the only living truth.
Number 4.
After Nangaku's comment about Sekito, he once more sent the attendant monk to Sekito to ask him a question. On arrival, the monk asked Sekito, "What is liberation?" Sekito said, "Who bound you?" The monk asked, "What is the pure land?" Sekito responded, "Who made you dirty?" The monk asked, "What is nirvana?" "Who gave you birth and death?" Sekito replied. The attendant monk came back to Nangaku and reported Sekito's answers. Nangaku put both hands together and made a gesture of touching his feet. At that time, Kengo, Ran, and Nangaku were thought to be the three masters in the country, and all three of them said, "From the stone head comes the lion's roar to my ear." The monk went back to Sekito and said that if there were anything the monk could do for him, to let him know. A little later, the master, Nangaku, came with his monks to see Sekito. Sekito stood up to receive him, and the two greeted each other. Later, Nangaku had a temple built for Sekito's convenience.
Friends, first the questions. The first question: is it not the same to call existence intelligent and loving as to call it God? It might not be the Christian concept of God, but there are other pantheistic concepts which see God in everything. It is not the same. The God gives a sense of personality, of limitedness. While existence gives you an unlimited, non-personal vastness, God cannot be equivalent to existence. And God has always been conceived by all religions, monotheistic or polytheistic, as the creator of existence. And existence is not a created phenomenon. It has been here always. So first, the God gives you an impression that He is the creator. Then many lies start arising out of the God. Then prayer becomes possible. Then worship becomes possible. Then statues of God become possible. then temples and churches and mosques start arising. Then organized religions become possible. God is the center of all organized religions. Once you accept God as a person, you have limited intelligence, invested intelligence into one person. I'm spreading it all over existence. The whole existence is intelligent, caring, compassionate, loving. But it is not a person. It is not limited in any way. It is unlimited, infinite and eternal. There is no beginning, no end. It is continuously evolving towards higher peaks and higher peaks. It is continuously fathoming depths beyond depths. There are skies beyond skies. There is no end to existence. It has no boundary. God is bound to be limited. And God is a fiction of human mind. Existence is not. You have created God in your own image. He is just sitting on a throne, an old man, of course. You cannot conceive God as young or a child with a long beard. Perhaps the beard must be longer than the God himself. Since eternity, he has never entered into barber's saloon. And I don't think that he has safety razors. But every morning in the bathroom, I don't think that he has a bathroom either. Because no mention of his bathroom in any scripture. He seems to be perfectly Indian. So beware of him. He must be using the whole sky as his toilet. When something falls on your head, it is a holy shit. Conceiving God as a person is going to create many troubles. No, not at all. Existence is a totally different concept. It is not your fiction. It is there. When you were not here, it was there. When you will not be here, it will be here. We come and go. We are just waves in this vast ocean of existence. We come and go. Existence remains. And to find that which remains is the ultimate truth. You don't have to worship nature. You don't have to pray to nature. Those things are only associated with a fiction of God. Existence is non-judgmental. I want to emphasize this fact as categorically as possible. God is judgmental. The Christian God has exactly declared that there will be a judgment day when he will choose those who are on his side, followers of Jesus Christ, his son, and those who are not on his side are against him. They will be thrown into hell fire for eternity. It is because of God all kinds of moralities arise. This is good, that is bad. What is the criterion? The scriptures. And the scriptures were written by primitive people, uneducated. They don't belong to our century. Existence does not write any scriptures and does not give any commandments. Existence does not tell you what to do and what not to do. Existence is absolutely non-judgmental. It is as compassionate to the sinner as to the saint. It makes no difference. Because in the eyes of existence, everything that is natural is beautiful. Only those who go against nature, religions call them saints. And nature simply feels sad for them. Existence simply feels that they are going astray. And by being astray, they will suffer. It is not that existence is giving them suffering and hell, punishment and reward. No. Existence simply is there. If you are in tune with it, you will be immensely rewarded. Nobody is rewarding you. Just the very tuning with existence is such a peace, such a joy, such a benediction. You are already rewarded. There is no reward beyond this. And those who are not in tune with nature and existence are already punished. You can see your sins. They can't smile, they can't laugh, they can't enjoy anything. They are the ugliest human beings who have fallen from humanity into some kind of darkness that knows no end. They are self-torturers, masochists, and they are already suffering. Their suffering is not caused by anybody else, it is caused by themselves. This is the criterion for me. If you are suffering, that means you are not in tune with nature. If you are miserable, that means you are not in tune with nature. So the moment you feel you are miserable, suffering, agony, immediately try to make the distance smaller, come closer to existence, and suddenly there will be light and there will be joy and there will be song and there will be celebration. To be in tune with existence is its own reward. Not to be in tune is its own punishment. So my approach is very clear and clean. If you make God then he is bound to judge you. And his judgment is going to be out of date. He will always be lagging behind human consciousness. And if you follow those scriptures which are creations of the priest, not of God, there is intrinsic proof of it. Hindus say Vedas are written by God Himself. And I cannot conceive the stupidity. Nobody in thousands of years have objected to the idea, because there is intrinsic proof in the Vedas itself that they are created by priests. There is no need for any outer proof. I will tell you just few proofs which are intrinsic. 98% prayers in the Vedas are from priests. God will not have a prayer. There is no other God whom He will pray. Just look at the point. God cannot be a worshipper. God cannot be in prayer. God cannot ask anything from anyone, because there is no one beyond Him. The whole Vedas are nothing but prayers. And the content of the prayers is so idiotic that it is a miracle that nobody raises the question. One of the so-called Hindu seers prays, of course, prays to God. That this year, just let your clouds rain in my fields and not in the fields of my enemies. Do you think this writing can come from God? Another seer, so-called self-styled seers, ask God that let my cows have more and more milk, and let my enemies' cows simply stop giving milk at all. These kind of things God will write. This is intrinsic proof that these are writings of ordinary worshippers, Brahmins, priests, and they are proclaiming for thousands of years that Vedas are written by God. All religions try to prove that their holy scripture is written by God. If not written, at least it is sent through a messenger. But the word is coming from God. Once you accept the fiction of God, you will have to accept these holy scriptures. And you will have to accept His judgment. And His judgment is absolutely against nature. Because these scriptures prescribe that you live an abnormal, stupid, insane life. Don't eat according to the needs of your body, fast. Don't live in the world, renounce. Go to the Himalayas, live in the caves. With difficulty man has come out of the caves. Thousands of years struggle has brought man out of the caves, and these so-called holy scriptures are sending back, go to the caves. But there is a certain psychological reason behind it. If you are fasting, you become more imaginary. Obviously, you have to imagine about food. That is the first imagination that comes. The whole night, you will be imagining that you are being invited by the king himself. And you are having a great feast. It is bound to happen. If you are sexually starved, you will have sexual dreams. If you are physically starved, you will have dreams about food. If you are thirsty, you will dream about water. Your dreams show what you need, what you are denying yourself. The dreams are indications from your very nature that you are unnecessarily going against nature. You will suffer. But all religions prescribe fasting as one of the virtues, great virtues. The reason is fasting helps hallucination. Now it is a scientific fact. If you fast for 3 weeks continuously and you are alone in a cave in the Himalayas, you will start hallucinating. By the end of the 2nd week, you will start talking to yourself. By the end of the 3rd week, you will start talking to God. Actual dialogue. You will answer from both the sides. You will ask the question and you will answer the question. And you will feel that the answer is coming from God. By the end of the 4th week, you will be able to see your God. Jesus Christ, or Krishna, or Buddha, whosoever you have been believing in, by the 4th week, you have lost all grip of intelligence, you have lost all grip about reality, you cannot make any distinction what is real and what is dream. You have fallen back into a state just like a small child. The small child cannot make in the beginning the distinction what is dream and what is real. In the dream he is playing with a toy and he wakes up in the morning and the toy is gone. And he starts crying, "Where is my toy?" He cannot make any distinction that the toy was a dream. It will take a little maturity, a little growth of intelligence to make the distinction in the real and the unreal. But just 4 weeks fasting, and you will lose all discrimination of your intelligence. Living alone is absolutely necessary for it. Because if somebody else is living, you will talk to him. That will be a release. But if you are living alone, and every religion prescribes to live alone, in monasteries, in your cells, or in caves, live alone. Why alone? So that you cannot talk to anybody. Then your whole mind is so much boiling to talk that you start talking to yourself. You have seen people on the street also. You can see their lips are moving and they are alone and they are going fast towards their office or their home and their lips are moving. Sometimes they are making gestures, throwing away something. What is happening to them? They are going like a robot towards their house because it has become habitual. They don't need to think about where to move right and where to move left and where. This will be done by the legs themselves. So they can. I have seen people counting money on their fingers. I have seen people with lips moving. I have loved a story very much. A man had become the concentration of the whole crowd that was gathered in a waiting room on a junction railway station, because the train was late and all were eagerly waiting for the train, but everybody was focused on a person who was resting in a chair. His lips were moving, and once in a while he will start smiling, once in a while he will giggle, once in a while he will throw something away. Finally, they could not resist the temptation. What is going on? So one man asked him, "What is going on? Sometimes you giggle, sometimes you smile, sometimes you throw away something." He said, "Nothing. I'm just telling jokes to myself. When a really good joke I hear, I smile. And when a joke is so fresh and new, I giggle. And when I see some old joke, I simply throw it away." And he is telling jokes to himself, and all jokes must be old. Everybody said, "You are having great time. We are unnecessarily worried about the train, that it is going later and later." In India it happens. Once I was stuck in Allahabad. First they declared the train is 2 hours late. So I said, not much problem. I will reach to the place in right time where I am going. After 2 hours, when I went to inquire, they said, "Now it is 4 hours late." I said, "Is it going backwards?" Because how it can be 4 hours late when it was just 2 hours late? And those 2 hours are gone. The train should have been on the platform. It means it is now 6 hours late. What is happening? Is the train going backwards? The man was at a shock. He could not answer me, because my question was absolutely logical. What is happening to the train? It was late, I can understand, but it cannot go on moving backwards. Next time I will come after 4 hours, it may be 12 hours late, because it is going backwards. You have to answer me. He said, "What I can do? Just I have been informed by the station master that it is now 4 hours late." I said, "Go and ask the station master, otherwise I am going to report to the police." He said, "For what?" I said, "Your station master and you both are crackpots. What is happening to the train? How it can be more late? 9:00 PM. He rushed towards the station master, and the station master came to cool me down. He said, "It is not going backwards." Then I asked, "What is happening?" He said, "I don't know. Just the information comes from the other station that it is 4 hours late. I said, you inquire the other station from where you are receiving the message. Because if it goes a little more late, I will go to the police station and find out where is the madhouse in Allahabad. And you will be arrested. He said, but it is not my fault. I said, I don't care whose fault it is, you find it out. Why the train is going backwards? But in India it happens every day. Just to keep people hoping, they don't know exactly how much late it is. So 2 hours late. If it comes early, it is good. If it does not come early, then again it becomes late. But to tell people that it is 12 hours late will be too sucky. So make it easy. 2 hours, 4 hours, 2 hours more. It is just coming within 1 hour. By and by it is 12 hours late. So they could not answer me because the reality I knew. What was the reality? The reality was they had no idea how much late it is. Then you are in the waiting room, sitting, watching people, and I have seen people, nothing to do. They will start moving their lips, talking to themselves, just keeping themselves engaged. Otherwise, it is an agony need to think that you are caught up in this place and nobody knows how long. Sometimes the train is 24 hours late, sometimes I have seen it even 48 hours late. I don't know how this goes on. But I found it out once. I was coming from Chanda to Gondia, a very small train. Now those small trains have almost disappeared, only in few places. That train was a passenger train, and that small line only passenger trains, and it was stopping at every station. And one of my friends who has died was a rich man, and he has forced me to travel. He said, it is a beautiful place to travel in this train. On both sides, it is scenic. Mountains, rivers, forests, wild forests. So I agreed, otherwise I was going to fly, because this train will take 12 hours while I could fly within 15 hours, 15 minutes. I said, okay, this time let us try. You have been again and again telling me that it is a beautiful world around the train. It is almost unpopulated area, aboriginal area. People live in the deep forest. On one station he told me, come down. It was mango season. And that place, outside the station, there were such beautiful mango trees, perhaps for miles. And the smell of mangoes, and hundreds of cuckoos creating such beautiful sounds, such beautiful sounds. He took me out. I said, what are you doing? He said, come on with me. You will never find such beautiful mangoes anywhere. So he climbed on a tree and he told me to come behind me. I said, but what about the train? He said, don't be worried. That is my responsibility. Unless I come down, the train will not move. I said, this is strange, because you have not told to anybody, to the station master or to the driver. He started laughing. He said, just look up. The driver is ahead of us. Unless I allow him to come down, the train cannot move. You don't be worried. And the driver started laughing. He said, that's right. So we enjoyed mangoes for almost 1 hour. And whenever the driver tried to come down, my friend said, I will pull your leg and throw you down. Just remain there. The train cannot move unless we are finished. You eat mangoes, there is no harm. So we kept the driver on the tree and the whole passengers of the train were wondering what is the matter. Because that was the only train on that line. One time it goes, one time it comes. So there is no question of another train coming. The station master was looking where the driver has gone. The conductor was looking all around where, and we were seeing everybody is searching the driver. And driver was imprisoned completely because he could not cross us. We were there to hit him back. Just go up. Then I knew that how these trains get late. It can happen only in India. All religions preach fast, go in aloneness, and constantly visualize, imagine your God. It is a psychological fact that in 4 weeks' time, even the most intelligent person will start wavering into what is real and what is imaginary. What to say about ordinary masses whose intelligence quotient is not more than 7 years. Their mind remains stuck between 7 and 14. Their body goes on growing 70, 80, but their mind remains between 7 and 14. Very rarely a man passes beyond 14. So these people who have a retarded mind, and only a retarded mind can belong to a religious organization, can believe in a fiction of God, can believe in heaven and hell, can pray to the empty sky. These people renounce the world out of fear and greed. And when they are alone, they start visualizing. Fasting is absolutely necessary. It weakens not you, but also your mind. Have you ever thought about that no vegetarian in India has ever received a single Nobel Prize? And in fact, this should be the one to receive most of the Nobel Prize because they think they are eating the purest food. So their mind should be the more pure and clear and clean than the non-vegetarians. But not a single jnana has received a Nobel Prize and is not possible ever, because something is missing in their food which is needed for intelligence to grow. But they won't listen. I have been talking to their conferences and they were all angry. They were ready to kill me, but they won't listen. I was telling them that it is perfectly good to be vegetarian, but you should understand that there are few proteins which are missing in your food and you have to substitute them. The best way is to start eating eggs which are unfertilized. So they are just vegetable. There is no life in them. When the hen has not been hanging around a cock, she is still going to give eggs every day. She is not dependent on the cock. But the egg will be just vegetarian. There will be no life in it. And it has all proteins and vitamins which are needed for the intelligence to grow. But just the word egg is enough to freak them out. That you are teaching us to eat eggs. I said, you don't understand. I am not teaching you to eat eggs. I am teaching you to eat unfertilized eggs. They said, eggs are eggs. They will not understand a simple phenomenon that when it is unfertilized, it is not an egg. It is just the shape of the egg. Otherwise, it is pure protein, vitamins, and so cheap and so natural. And it is an absolute necessity for your intelligence to grow. You will be surprised to know that Jews get 40% of Nobel Prizes and the whole remaining world gets the 60%. And Jews are not many. Because everybody is killing them. For 4,000 years, the whole world is killing Jews. Mohammedans are killing them, Christians are killing them. Everybody is against them. So they are a very small portion of humanity. But they get 40% Nobel Prizes. What is the problem? And when I worked out what is the reason, and when I told Indians, everybody was against me. I finally stopped talking to the masses because these idiots won't understand. The Jews are one of the most intelligent people on the earth. You just see, Jesus has turned half the humanity to Christianity. Karl Marx, another Jew, has turned the other half into communism. Sigmund Freud, the third Jew, exploits both. The fourth Jew, Albert Einstein, created the atomic energy and nuclear weapons to destroy the whole world. These four Jews are the most important people in the world. is strange. And the reason is even more strange. That is their circumcision. It is not a laughing matter at all. It has a scientific basis. And just now, scientists are agreeing to the fact that circumcision has something to do with Jewish intelligence. Because as they have been working on the brain, they have found that there are millions of small nerves in the brain, 7 million exactly. In this small skull, 7 million small, they are not visible to the eyes, and they control your whole behavior, your intelligence, your functioning of the body, your digestion, your blood circulation, they control everything. And the intelligence is controlled by a certain center in the brain. Just by the side of the intelligence center is the center that controls your sexuality. They are too close. The more intelligent a person is, the more sexual he will be. The more sexual a person is, there is possibility of more energy for creation, for intelligence. And what happens when the smallest child just born is immediately circumcised? The sexual organism is connected with the brain center. And particularly in a small child, everything is very soft, flexible. And to cut that small child's unnecessary skin from the sexual organ gives a certain shock. And that sucks goes not only to the sexual center, because the sexual center is so close to the intelligence that the shock goes to the intelligence center also. And that shock, in a certain way, wakens it up. Mohammedans also circumcise, but not in the childhood. Later on, then it is useless, because now everything has become fixed. Now things are not so volatile, not so flexible. So Mohammedans don't get the same Nobel Prizes as the Jews. Both religions, Christianity and Mohammedanism, are byproduct of Judaism. And there was a great debate in the time of the Emperor Constantine whether to continue circumcision for Christians. Because he was a Roman and he was the president of the Council of Nicaea that was deciding what to do about circumcision, because they were all Jews converted into Christians. And Constantine voted against it. That's why Christians stopped the circumcision. Now they are starting again. In America now it is an absolute thing. It does not matter what religion you belong. Every child that is born in the hospital should be circumcised. And every child has to be born into a hospital, not in home. So immediately the doctor has to circumcise the child. The reason is double. It is hygienic. It prevents many diseases. It keeps you cleaner. And the secret reason is it gives a shock to your intelligence center that certainly starts functioning better than any other center. I am absolutely in favor the whole world should be circumcised. And immediately after the birth, the quickly you do it, the better. But to tell people the truth about anything is very difficult. To have eyes in a valley of blind people is not an easy job. Keeping a person for 4 weeks fasting destroys all those proteins and vitamins that make his intelligence. So you don't know the dynamics of fasting. Why all religions are insisting for fasting? Because it destroys the 4 week, at the most, one can go on living on the storage. After 4 week, there is no storage. And immediately, within 6 minutes, if they are not supplied the right amount of proteins, oxygen, the right amount of vitamins, those small nerves break down. Once those small nerves break down, you don't have any capacity to discriminate whether Christ is standing before you or it is your imagination, your projection. With open eyes you start seeing dreams. And it needs aloneness, so nobody disturbs your imagination. And it needs constant visualization, praying. The whole day in monasteries, what people are doing? The whole day praying, Ave Maria, Ave Maria. And keeping Maria's picture and prostrating and fasting and Ave Maria. In few days' time, the picture will start moving its lips. Ave Maria is coming alive. And that is a great satisfaction to the stupid mind. Soon Ave Maria will start coming out of the picture. A great revolution, a great revelation. That's what he was waiting for. He touches the feet of nobody, but he feels the feet, just as you feel things in your dream. He has destroyed the barrier between dream and reality. To destroy that barrier, fasting and aloneness and constant visualization is used. You can visualize God, but you cannot visualize existence. And there is no need to visualize, it is already there. The trees are there, the rivers, the ocean, the mountains, the stars, the whole sky is there. It is not your imagination. And it is an objective phenomenon. You all can agree that it is a full moon night. But somebody who is seeing Jesus, you will not agree. because you will not see Jesus, only he is seeing Jesus. It is a projection. If it was a reality, then there was no question. Others will also see. As they see the full moon, as they see the sunrise, as they see roses, and everybody agrees that yes, there is a rose flower. Maybe they have different opinions. A poet may be more sensitive. A painter may look at the rose with a different eyes because he has a sensitivity for colors. A man who is an expert about perfumes will have a different sensitivity to the rose because he will smell it deeply, that you cannot do. And for a man like me, who has allergy to perfumes, my gardener Mukta has to keep all the flowers outside my windows, which are never opened. So I can see the roses, but the perfume cannot reach to me. And poor Mukta has to work hard, because keeping those roses around my room, there are such big, huge trees, so much shadow, that roses cannot blossom perfectly unless they have sunlight. So she has to constantly change the flower parts. But she manages for me to see the roses all around me, wherever I am in the house. She is deceiving the sun and she is deceiving the roses. She has to continuously move in a rotation. Whenever a flower comes to its total blossoming, she brings it by my side around the glasses. And once she sees that the plant is not happy without the sun, she takes the plant to the sun. So she has to keep a double row, a rotation. It is a rotary club. But she manages perfectly well. She knows, I love the roses, but I cannot tolerate their fragrance. I am too sensitive to their fragrance, that immediately disturbs me. So it may be different to different people, but the existence of the rose will be objective. Everybody will accept, except few blind people. But they can also touch the rose. They can also smell the rose. Some idea they can have of the rose, except the color. They can feel its softness, its velvety petals. And because the blind man has no eyes, eyes use your 80% energy. And other four senses have only distribution of 5% to each. 20% energy is used by other four senses. Eyes use 80%. So the blind man distributes his 100% energy to four senses. 25% to each. That's why blind people are good singers. They have a better ear than anybody else. Their touch has more energy than a man with eyes, because their hands are carrying 25% energy, your hand only 5%. So they may not be able to see the flower and the color, but they can touch and their touch will be deeper than yours. And they can smell and their smell will be deeper than yours. But we can come to a conclusion that there is something objective. Your dream is purely yours. You cannot share it with anybody. I have told you about two friends who were talking. One said, last night was a great night. In my dream, I went for fishing. And my God, I have never seen such big fish in my whole life. Just to catch one fish and to carry it to the bank, I felt I was not strong enough. The fish was so big. And fish upon fish. And I was lying down on the beach. The whole beach was full. You should have seen. You should have been there. The other friend said, that's nothing. Last night I dreamt that two naked women are lying by my side, one on my left, one on my right. I looked at the right and I was amazed. It was Marilyn Monroe, the American actress, the concubine of President Kennedy. And on other side was Sophia Lorena. Both naked. And you are talking about fish, you idiot. The other man also became angry. He said, if this was the case, why you did not give me a phone call immediately? What you are going to do with two women? The man said, I did. Phone your wife. And she said, he has gone fishing. You cannot share your dreams. You cannot share your hallucinations. So a follower of Krishna will see Krishna, not Christ. And a follower of Christ will see Christ, not Krishna. And when he is seeing, you can be there, you won't see anything at all. So it is just a projection of open eyes dreams. To make it possible, you need fasting, you need destroying your intelligence, and you need aloneness. So nobody disturbs you and tells that you are an idiot, there is nobody. I can see the plain wall. Where is your Krishna? I don't see. And I can bring other people's as a proof that nobody sees. So be alone. So nobody disturbs your projection, your hallucination. God has been one of the greatest disturbances to human evolution because it has created people hallucinating, destroying their intelligence, destroying their possibility of becoming a Buddha. Existence has its own wisdom. Existence has its own love. Just you have to experiment. And now science is very clear about it. In fact, the first scientist who became aware about the sensitivity and intelligence of trees was so shocked because he felt we don't have that sensitivity and that intelligence, a totally different dimension. And we have never bothered about. And we have lived with trees for millennia, millions of years. But we have never bothered whether those trees have any intelligence, any sensitivity. This is just within 10 years' time that scientists became aware. Now they have a special instrument like cardiogram. Exactly the same type of mechanism. They put the cardiogram around the tree. And the cardiogram start giving the graph how the tree is feeling. And the graph is very harmonious. Sun is rising. A cool breeze is blowing. And the tree is dancing in the wind, in the sun. She is really happy. The graph is very harmonious. There is no tension in the tree's mind. No trouble, no anxiety. The graph goes on harmonious, and suddenly one gardener appears with an axe in his hand, and suddenly the graph starts trembling. It is no more harmonious. Tree is feeling worried. But this happens only if the gardener is going to cut the tree. It's strange. The tree is not bothered by the axe. The tree is bothered by the intention of the gardener. When it became clear to the scientists, it was really shocking. First they thought it is the axe. But even tree has no eyes. But must be some way of perceiving. But finally they found that it is not the axe. It is the intention of the person. Because one time they brought a gardener with an axe just to cut the trees, the same tree that they were working on. The gardener has to cut one of the branch. And the tree got completely freaked out. The graph was showing that the tree is absolutely against what is going to happen. It was shocking that the trees don't have eyes. How far away gardener with his axe. And then they tried one gardener coming with the axe, but no intention of cutting the tree. And the graph remained harmonious. So it was not the axe, it was the desire, the intention of the gardener that the tree somehow was receptive. And then they worked on, for 10 years the work has been going on, particularly in Soviet Union. They wired other trees also around the tree, the main tree, and they found that it is not only the tree which is being to be cut, but other trees also feel sympathy for the tree. Although their grapes don't go that crazy, but they become disharmonious. They are feeling that one of their friends, one of their neighbors is going to be cut. But this happens only if there is intention. If there is no intention and the malik comes with the axe and passes by, no tree gives any signal of worry, anxiety, anguish. This whole existence has its own way of being intelligence. Our intelligence is not the only intelligence. A famous scientist, John Lilly, has been working and he has got almost crazy. He has been working on dolphins, and dolphins have a very different language. Nobody has ever thought that except man anybody has language. And dolphin's head is the bigger head than man's head. It has more nerves than the man's head. Perhaps it is a higher stage of intelligence than man, because it uses a certain system which is called sonar, because it creates a certain sound in the water, and that sound travels into the water for miles and reaches to the person, another dolphin, to whom it is addressed without any wire. This is wireless system. And there are thousands of dolphins in the area. To a certain dolphin, perhaps the boyfriend or the girlfriend, a message, and the message is just a sound we cannot hear. It is below the range of our hearing. Only through instruments, when we magnify it, we can hear it. A certain very beautiful sound. But that sound must be directed to a particular dolphin. Perhaps that particular dolphin has a name, an address, and the sound reaches, and soon you will find the other dolphin coming rushing to the spot from where the first dolphin has given the signal that come soon. Lily has been working almost his whole life, and he has become almost insane working with dolphins. Just now one friend suggested him to come here, forget for few days dolphins and meditate few days so you calm down. Because his shock is great. The dolphins have a language that we cannot understand. We cannot even hear. And their language is capable to travel miles and miles in the ocean and reaches to the right address. And dolphins are very loving animals. Very playful, very joyous. They have never attacked any human being or any other dolphin. No fight, no quarrel. If you are swimming, they will swim with you. If you are playing with them, they will play with you. They are perfectly happy with human beings. There is no problem at all. The whole existence. I used to have a Mali, a gardener, very old man. I have found that once in a while, when he was not aware that I am watching, I may be inside the house and I looked at him through the window, he was talking to the trees. I caught him one day red-handed. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Don't tell anybody. They will think I am mad. But the truth is that I feel a certain affinity. My whole life I have worked with trees and I have always talked to them. And to my surprise, if I put two plants of equal height and I talk to one plant and not to the other, and I give equal nourishment, equal care, equal water, equal sun, equal manure to both. But to one I talk with great love, I caress with my hands. That tree grows faster. Soon, within a month, it has a double height than the other tree. Although everything is equal, only one thing is missing, my love. And he was winning every year the competition for flowers. He was bringing the greatest roses I have ever seen, greatest dahlias I have ever seen. And his strategy was to talk to the flowers, then don't let me down. The competition is coming closer. You have to give me one big flower, the biggest that you can manage. Once I became intimate to him, and he knew that I will not tell anybody, I understand him, and I don't think he is mad. He is working perfectly. Poor fellow, if he was educated and scientifically, he would have found many secrets about trees. But I have seen it with my own eyes, because he was with me for almost 9 years. And when I left, he wanted to come with me, but I said, in Bombay I won't have a garden. He even wrote to America when I was there, that now you have such a big place there, why don't you call me? Although I am too old, not much of use, but still, what I can do with trees, nobody else can do. And he was right. Existence has multidimensional intelligence. We are only one section of this vast universe. Don't think for a single moment that I am putting existence in place of God. No. God does not exist. Existence exists. That's why we call it existence. The second question. It is very easy for me to say, I have not believed in God since I was a child, and even then I was not so sure. But this habit of the mind to try to turn the mysteries into superstitions is very deep-rooted and slippery. The other night when you were speaking, I was reminded of the occasions when I have attributed these qualities of omnipotence, omnipresence, omniscience to you, are when thoughts of your death have filled me with fear and dread much more than the loss of any god. It seems this disease of God is hiding deep in the bones and pops out like some obscene intruder when I least expect it, and where I certainly don't want it. It is easy to change your prisons. The new prison looks better. It is easy to change your chains, your slaveries. Because any slavery, however different from the old one, is still deep down the same. And that's what people go on doing. Hindus become Christians, Christians become Hindus. They are only changing their slavery, they are only changing their prisons, they are only changing their handcuffs, their chains. Nothing is changed. So when you hear God is dead, and your intellect is convinced that God never existed, it is nowhere to be found. It is intellectual conviction. But you are not just intellect. You are emotion, you are sentiment, you are feeling, which are deeper than intellect. And the concept of God has entered into your emotions, into your sentiments, into your feelings. So intellectually, it is the surface of your mind. You may be convinced, logically, rationally, there is no God. One of my friends, an old man, very intelligent, used to be a follower of Jai Krishnamurti, was of the same age as Jai Krishnamurti. I came into his life when he was very old. But he started coming to me, and he was absolutely intellectually a giant, convinced that there is no God, no hell, no heaven, no morality. This is all social convenience. His son was the Attorney General of that state where I was living. The Supreme Court of that state was in the city. One day he came running to me. They lived just 5 minutes walking distance. And he told me my father had a great heart attack, and the doctors are worried that he may have another attack coming. He is so weak, and he suddenly has remembered you and wants you to be there. So I went running with him. As I approached, they have put the whole room in darkness, air-conditioned room. I stood on the door. I heard some sound. That old man was repeating, "Hare Krishna, Hare Rama." I could not believe. His whole life he was denying, and now he's repeating Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. I went very slowly, not to disturb him, sat by his side, listened closely that he is repeating Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. I shook him. He opened his eyes. I said, "What are you doing? Just one heart attack and a whole philosophy gone?" He said, "This is not the time to discuss. And this is not the time to take any risk. Just leave me alone. You just sit by my side and let me pray to God. I know intellectually there is no God, but who knows? What is the harm? Anyway, I am dying. It is better to repeat his name. In case he exists, it will be helpful. If he does not exist, what is the harm? I just repeated few times his name, that's all." I said, "This is not the question. It is a question of your whole integrity. You are a very split man. It was only intellect, and that what I was saying to you again and again, that this is intellectual rationality, and that was the failure of Jai Krishnamurti. Because he was only talking to people intellectually, convincing them intellectually, but he has no method, no meditation. That people can experience it deeper than the feeling. People can go deeper than the heart. They can reach to their being, and only then a tremendous light arises, which is unwavering. Whether death comes or heart attack comes, it makes no difference. And he became okay. After a few days, he came to see me and he said, "Don't tell it to anybody." I said, "I am going to tell everybody. And I am going to send a message to Jai Krishnamurti." And I did. I said, "These are your followers, lifelong followers. And you have depended on these people." And Krishnamurti's last statement before he died agreed with me. His last statement was that I am dying a frustrated man. People have used me as entertainment. Nobody has listened. But it was not the fault of the people. It was his own fault. He was just talking to them intellectually and never giving them any indication to go deeper. Unless you go deeper, you will shift your projections from one to another. If there is no God, you will make me your God. And certainly I am not God. I have never created this ugly mess that you see around the world. I never created Adolf Hitler and Genghis Khan and Timur Lane and Nader Shah and Benito Mussolini. I never created these people. Don't make me responsible. And I am not omnipotent. I am just sitting in my chair, that's all. Omnipotent means I will need a chair in which the whole universe fits. And I am not omnipresent. I am not a peeping Tom to look into your bedroom. That's what God used to do. Watching even your bathroom from the keyhole. I am not omniscient either. I don't know what is going to happen next moment. I am simply human, just awake. Just fully alert, conscious, and responding to life moment to moment according to my awareness, my consciousness. Just a pure mirror, reflecting whatever comes in front of me. Don't project anything on me, but I can understand your trouble. Your trouble is intellectually you are convinced, but you have not known the truth. From deeper sources of your being, you have to know it through meditation that there is no God. Existence is self-sufficient. It does not need any God, any fiction. Once this happens inside you, at the deepest core, you will never project the same old stupid superstitions again. Only meditation can bring a metamorphosis to your being. Krishnamurti died a failure because he never thought that he is only dealing with people's intellect. Intellect is part of the mind. And Krishnamurti never helped anybody to go beyond mind. I suspect perhaps he himself never got beyond the mind. Otherwise, how he can miss it? If he had gone beyond the mind, then his whole effort would have been a long life of 90 years to help people to go beyond the mind. When you start looking beyond the mind, there is no God, but this existence becomes so beautiful, so intelligent, so charismatic, so self-sufficient, it needs nothing else but only meditation can do that miracle. The third question. Yesterday I heard you say that prayer is something directed towards the outside. What about gratefulness? I have the feeling that gratitude does not necessarily have an outer object. Also, does gratitude happen only because of a declared or undeclared desire that is fulfilled? You are not aware that you have changed the word from gratefulness to gratitude. They are two different words. Gratefulness is always towards the outside. And gratefulness is always because deep down you wanted something directly or indirectly and it has been given to you. That's why you are grateful. Gratefulness simply means thankfulness. That will make it clear. You thank the person who has fulfilled a desire which was hidden in you, whether you were aware of it or not. But something has been gratified. Hence, you feel a thankfulness. Thankfulness is going to be outwards. It may be thankfulness towards God, which does not exist. It can be thankfulness towards a friend who exists. But thankfulness is a gratification of conscious or unconscious desire being fulfilled. Gratitude is a totally different phenomenon, not in the dictionaries. In the dictionaries, gratefulness, thankfulness, gratitude, all are put into the same category. Existence is not according to your dictionaries. Gratitude has no outward object, neither inward object. Gratitude is almost like a fragrance arising out of a flower. It is an experience not directed to anybody. When you reach to your very source of being, where you are completely in the mood of the spring, and the flowers are showering on you, you suddenly feel a gratitude not directed to anybody, just as a fragrance arising out of you, just as incense brings ripples of smoke and fragrance moving towards the unknown sky and disappearing. Gratitude arises out of you just like a fragrance, not as a thankfulness to anybody. It is the shadow, the byproduct of your becoming the Buddha. It is not a gratification of any desire. Because if you have any desires, conscious or unconscious, you cannot become a Buddha. It is only when all desires are passed on, you have transcended all desires and demands, that you become a Buddha. And out of a Buddha, a fragrance radiates. That fragrance has many elements in it. It is gratitude, it is compassion, it is love, it is blissfulness, it is ecstasy, it is manifold, multidimensional. Now the sutra. After Nangaku's comment about Sekito, he once more sent the attendant monk to Sekito to ask him a question. On arrival, the monk asked Sekito, "What is liberation?" Before I discuss Sekito's answer, I will tell you a small anecdote about Al-Hillaz Mansur, the Sufi mystic. A man came to him and asked the same question, "What is liberation?" He was sitting in a mosque with beautiful pillars all around. Listening to the question, Al-Hillaz Mansur went immediately towards a pillar and, holding the pillar by both the hands, started shouting, "Help me!" The man could not understand what is happening. He has just asked about liberation. And this man seems to be mad. And he is holding the pillar and he is asking the man, "Please help me, the pillar is holding me. And it is not leaving me. Liberate me." The man said, "You are mad. You are holding the pillar. The pillar is not holding you." Mansur said, "I have answered. Just get out of the place. Nobody is making you bound." That was Sekito's answer. "Who bound you? Why you are seeking liberation?" This is the right approach of Zen. To look into your bondage. Don't bother about liberation. Your bondage is false and your own creation. Who has made you a slave? You yourself. And now you are asking, "Liberate me." Nobody can liberate you because nobody has enslaved you. It is your own game. The answer is very hard, but very clear and very truthful. Sekito said, "Who bound you? First tell me, what is your bondage? Who has done it to you? Why you are asking for liberation?" Once you look into your bondage, you will simply start laughing. The bondage is your own creation. You can drop it right now. And once you drop the bondage, liberation has been your nature. You don't have to be liberated. You are born liberated. You have been liberated since the beginning, but you get again and again in a bondage. Perhaps the bondage gives you a certain security, certain safety. The bondage gives you a certain feeling of doing something against the bondage. But you are, in your consciousness, absolutely liberated, always liberated. It is as if you lie down and close your eyes and it starts shouting, "Wake me up." Now it is very difficult to wake a man who is awake. It is easy to wake up a man who is asleep. You can throw cold water, a bucket full of water on his eyes, just ice cold, and he will jump. You can take his blanket and he will immediately shout that, "What are you doing?" But if a man is awake and lying with closed eyes and says to you that, "Please wake me up," that's what Sekito is saying to the monk who asked, "What is liberation?" Sekito said, "Who bound you? You have always been liberated. You are the Buddha. You are the awakened one. It is your own fabrication, fiction of bondage. You can try a small experiment, just sitting in your room. Put your fingers this way, hold the hand, close your eyes and just think that whatever I do, I cannot open my hands. For at least 5 minutes you continue repeating with closed eyes, "Whatever I do, I cannot open my hands." Then after 5 minutes, make every effort to open it. Put your whole energy in opening it and you will be surprised. The more you try, the more it seems to be impossible. You have hypnotized yourself into a bondage. Now the only way to open the hands which you have hypnotized into a bondage is not to make any effort of opening, just relax. And the hands will be open. Without your making any effort. Your effort is going against you because you have hypnotized yourself. Now you cannot, with effort you cannot open your hands. We have hypnotized ourselves in all kinds of bondages. And then we try how to be liberated. Then we make great effort. Every effort brings more trouble. The hands become more tighter. Then you start freaking out, "My God, what to do?" The more effort I make, the more they become tighter. It seems impossible. Because you don't understand the simple process. Hypnosis can be dissolved only by relaxation. You just relax. You don't make any effort to open. The hands will open by themselves. Because closing is an effort. Opening is just effortless. You don't have to make any effort. That's why, have you seen any dead man dying with closed fists? Can a dead man manage to keep his fist closed? Impossible. Because the fist needs effort and a dead man cannot make any effort. So all people die with open hands. All people are born with closed fists. Just watch a small child, fist, and watch a dead man. The hand is open, because the dead man is completely relaxed. For the first time in his whole life, there is no tension. The monk asked another question, what is the pure land? But this is just going round about the same thing. Sekito responded, who made you dirty? Why are you bothering about pure land? The monk asked, what is nirvana? Who gave you birth and death? They are fictions. Your birth is a fiction, your death is a fiction. Your body is born, your body will die, but you have never been born. You are coming, passing through many bodies, many births, many deaths, and you are going on and on from beginning to end, eternity to eternity. You are an eternal life. So what is the point of asking what is nirvana? Nirvana simply means getting rid of birth and death, and birth and death both are fiction. So just even to say getting rid of is not right. What is right is just to look deeply into everything, your bondage, and you will find it is your creation. Your idea that you are a sinner, dirty, is your idea. Perhaps you have borrowed it from others, the preachers, the priests, the so-called religious saints, they are making you feel dirty, sinners, getting ready to fall into hell. They are making all kinds of humiliations to you. And people go on listening to humiliations. From my very childhood, I was fighting with every saint who passed from my village. My parents were worried, my family was worried that you disturb every meeting. Whenever some saint comes, the whole village gathers to listen to him, and you stand up in the middle. And my father will beat his head that again he is standing. Again disturbance. Because my basic point was that you are humiliating people by calling them sinners. Just tell me, who is a sinner here and what sin he has committed? You are making a generalized statement that you are all sinners. Just point out the person who is a sinner. And these saints were telling to people that don't be attached to women because they are nothing but bones, flesh, mucus, blood covered in a bag of skin. Why you are getting attached to them? And I will immediately stand up and I will say, what about you? You think you are made of gold? Women are bones, blood, mucus, flesh. Okay, what you are? And if blood, mucus and bones hug each other, what is the problem? Rubbing their skin, what is the problem? Why are you making so fuss? What else they can do? But all the holy scriptures are full of these descriptions in detail about women only, not about men. It's strange. Both are made of the same stuff. And in fact, man comes from the woman. The woman never comes from the man. Right now in America, they have allowed in many states lesbian marriages. So a woman can marry a woman, there is no problem. Now it is legalized. And this year they are expecting 40,000 babies out of lesbian marriage. This simply, one of the partner who is ready to carry a baby for 9 months, go to the hospital, get an insemination, an injection. What man is? Just an injection. A syringe. Any syringe can do that work. So I used to tell to the saints that you have only just a syringe. And that syringe is also made of bones and flesh and is covered with dirty skin. So what you are bragging about? And why you are making these people humiliated? And they are all listening with their eyes down, because he is telling great truths. All scriptures are telling that truth. So my father will take me home, because you disturbed the whole meeting. People have started leaving. And the Mahatma is very angry. I said, I don't care. If he is angry, he is going against his own teachings. He will suffer in hell. Because he was teaching against anger and now he is angry. So I have shown him his real face. My father will say, just you come home. Sometimes I feel worried that they will not even beat you, they will start beating me. And you are such a fellow. Not a single saint can pass from the village who is not being disturbed by you. And we keep the information as secret as possible, that you should not come to know that some Mahatma, some saint is delivering a speech. We give you money to go to the movie, and the moment they will give me money, I will say, keep the money. I am coming with you. Because this money is never given to me for the movie, it is given only to protect the Mahatma. I am not going. I am going to the real show. It became so difficult from the problems that I created to the Mahatmas. Because it was a simple question that if two persons are rubbing their skin, what sin is there? You just tell me. I am rubbing the skin. Is this sin? Just it is cleaning my hands, warming my hands. And if a man and woman are rubbing their skin, they will fall into hell. And just look your belly. All the Mahatmas in India have big bellies. And they are teaching people, don't eat with taste. And they themselves, I said, from where this belly is coming? Stand up. show your belly to the whole people. You are eating too much and the country is hungry. And I know because of this belly, you cannot make love to a woman. So now you are teaching everybody not to make love to any woman. It is because of this belly, not because of your religion. Such bellies I have seen, you will not believe. Muktananda's guru was Nityananda. Perhaps he has the biggest belly, Everest. He was continuously lying down because of that belly. Walking was difficult. And lying down, it does not seem that Nityananda has belly. It seems belly has Nityananda. Belly is just like a mountain. On this side a small head. On this side two small legs. These creatures have become great Mahatmas. I have never seen such a perfect belly. And he was continuously lying down and eating sweets. And worshippers are bringing sweets and halwa and puri and making his belly bigger and bigger. When I saw him for the first time, I said, this man someday is going to burst. He is using his belly as a balloon. Now, this man cannot make love to a woman, that is true. Where you can find such an inverted belly woman? Can't understand. Yes, it seems to be impossible, a puzzle, a coin. Because this man can make love only if he can find a woman with an inverted belly. So they fit together. Obviously, because he cannot do something, he will talk to everybody that be celibate. He is out of necessity, suffering. He is trying to create the same suffering around him. People enjoy other people's suffering. Because that gives them a chance that we are higher than you. Look at us. We are happy, always silent, peaceful. And the reality is they cannot stand up, they cannot walk. One very famous Mahatma, Shivananda, who had many followers in the West, he used to be a doctor, and a doctor should do such a stupid thing to himself makes it more difficult to understand. He was eating so much that he could not walk without two persons holding his hands. Even he could not raise his hand. His hand was so heavy, so fat, that one person will take his one hand, another person will take his another hand, and then the small walk will be done. And he was telling people that you have to be following the five great principles of Hinduism. First is aswad, no taste. And what happened to this man? And he was a doctor. And I told him, when I went to Rishikesh and I saw him, I told him that what kind of doctor you were. It seems your certificate is bogus. You can't even take care of your body. And you have become a monster. You cannot raise your own hand. It has become so heavy. Everything out of proportion. Big belly, big fat hands, the legs, elephant legs. And this person is teaching to the whole world that you are not the body. That you are the soul. And who are these monsters? Just bodies, no soul at all. Because I can't see any space in them. They are so filled up with junk that I don't think they can have soul also. Watch. Sekito is saying is absolutely right. Tremendous truths in small statements. What is the pure land? Sekito responded, who made you dirty? You are always pure. That is the pure land, your inner space. Never has gathered any dirt. That mirror is always clean. No dirt can reach into that depth, into that invisible beyond. The monk asks, what is nirvana? He is not understanding at all. Because the first question was the last question. All these are repetitions of the same thing. Nirvana is nothing but liberation. Liberation from all desires, liberation from all attachments, liberation from all bondage. What is nirvana? Liberation from birth, from death. And Sekito said, who gave you birth and death? It is you, your desire. Just try a small experiment. In the night when you are going to sleep, wait, and at the last moment when you think now you are just on the verge of falling asleep, just say one. And go on saying one, 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 as you are crossing the border from waking towards sleep, one, one. One, perhaps 2-3 times after the boundaries cross, you may repeat one, 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 and then you will be fast asleep. In the morning watch, as you become aware that you are waking, you will be surprised. You are repeating one, one, one. It's strange. After 8 hours of sleep, that one was continuously being repeated inside you. The last thought when you go to sleep will be the first thought when you wake up. That is an absolutely guaranteed science. And why I am giving you this example? Because the last thought and the desire when you die will be your first desire to enter into a womb. If you die without a desire, without any thought, you will not enter into any womb. Nobody is forcing you into some womb. It is your desire, last desire, when you die. An ambition, some unfulfillment, some frustration. You wanted to be the prime minister and you missed. You wanted to be the richest man, you missed. You wanted a beautiful woman and you missed. Anything that is the last thing in you will take you into a new womb to fulfill your desire. Life is very merciful. Existence is very compassionate. It gives you chances upon chances, opportunities upon opportunities. If you die meditatively, without any desire, then there is no womb for you. No birth, no death. That's what Sekito is saying. Who has given you birth and death? You yourself, by your desires, by your ambitions, go on perpetuating the circle of birth and death. Stop desiring. That is nirvana. You move from death into cosmos, not into another womb. To move into the cosmos, to become one with the existence, is nirvana. It is also liberation. It is also freedom. It is also the pure paradise. Different names for one experience. The attendant monk came back to Nangaku and reported Sekito's answers. Nangaku put both hands together and made a gesture of touching his feet, although he was not there, but he accepted Sekito is enlightened. A very strange story. One day Sekito has come to him with a letter to deliver, and they could not find any attunement with each other, and Sekito has returned without delivering the letter. That time he was not enlightened. This time, on the same mountain where Nangaku had his temple and monastery, and the emperor has given the name to the whole mountain, Nangaku Mountain. On a small hilltop, on a flat stone, Sekito has settled after his master died. Nangaku heard about Sekito, that he is sitting just on a rock. He wanted to know whether he has become enlightened or not. He must have seen that very day when he has come as a disciple of Segen. He must have seen the man, his strength and his power, that he had asked a question and Nangaku had said, "Your question is very arrogant. You should ask in a humble way." And Sekito said to him, "I would rather fall into eternal hellfire, but I will not ask the question in any other way." And he returned directly. A man of steel. Nangaku was a famous master. When he heard these answers from the monk, he folded his hands, bowed down, recognized that that fellow Sekito has become enlightened. These answers cannot be given by any scholar. They cannot be borrowed knowledge. They can only arise as an experience. At that time, Kengo, Ren, and Nangaku were thought to be the three masters in the whole country. And all three of them said, "From the stone head comes the lion's roar to my ear." Because he was sitting on a stone with his shaved head, he became known as Stonehead Sekito. All three masters were staying by chance in Nangaku's monastery. And they all three said, "From the stone head comes the lion's roar to my ear." He is sitting far away, but I can hear the lion's roar. The monk went back to Sekito and said that if there were anything that the monk could do for him to let him know, a little later, the master Nangaku came with his monks to see Sekito. It is a strange phenomenon. Once Sekito has gone as a disciple to Nangaku, things have changed completely. Now Nangaku comes to pay his respects to Sekito. Sekito stood up to receive him, and the two greeted each other. Later, Nangaku had a temple built for Sekito's convenience. Zen gives a totally different taste. No competition. Nangaku made a temple for Sekito on his mountain for his convenience and took care his monk used to come to ask him whatever he needs. But soon thousands of people started coming to Sekito. He became one of the greatest masters of Zen. Was a very straightforward man, was not a philosopher or a theologian. His answers were very simple, but absolutely to the point. His sword was very sharp, and just in one blow, he used to cut people's whole intellect, their whole mind. He helped many people to become enlightened. Very few masters can claim that they have made so many people enlightened as Sekito. Chinezo wrote, "Suddenly light, suddenly dark, I am firefly too." You have seen the firefly? It goes on. As it opens its wings, you see the light. As it closes its wings, there is darkness. Suddenly light, suddenly darkness, I am a firefly too. Chinezo must be meditating deep in the night and the silence of the night, and many fireflies just moving around, sometimes dark, sometimes light, sometimes dark, sometimes light. Suddenly he became so attached tuned to the fireflies that he said, I am a firefly too. Because sometimes I am ignorant and sometimes I am awakened. Sometimes all is dark and sometimes everything becomes light. Every Buddha in his past was as ignorant as you are. And everybody who is ignorant has a future. Any day, suddenly light. And in that light, all the past, maybe millions of years, disappear like dream. Buddha used to measure people's age from the time they became enlightened. He did not count the previous age. So one day, a great emperor of those days, Prasenjita, was sitting by the side of Buddha, asking him questions, and an old monk may have been 75 years old at least, asked Prasenjita that, forgive me please, I have been waiting because I have to leave before the sun sets. I have to reach to the other village. The Buddhist monk cannot travel in the night. So I am in a hurry and I have to disturb just for a moment, just to touch Buddha's feet and if there is any message. Because I may not be seeing him again, who knows about tomorrow. So he touched the Buddha's feet and Buddha asked, how old you are? And that old man said, 4 years. Prasenjita could not believe and could not resist the temptation either to interfere. He said, what? 4 years? You must be at least 75. Buddha said, Prasenjita, you don't know, in my commune, we count only those years which he has lived as an enlightened being. Before that was just darkness and dreams, nightmares, misery, not worth counting. You are right, he is 75 years old according to ordinary world. But this is not an ordinary world. He is living in an extraordinary commune. As far as I am concerned, he is 4 years old. I was just asking him whether he remembers or not. He remembers. He knows what was real life. Only 4 years, and 71 years was just fake. It does not matter, has no meaning at all, there is no need to count it. Buddha said, with my blessings you can go because your remembrance is correct. Manisha's question. Friedrich Nietzsche wrote of himself, but I see his sentiments as being much more true of you. One day there will be associated with me a crisis like no other before on earth, of the profoundest collision of conscience, of a decision evoked against everything that until then had been believed in, demanded, sacrificed. It is my fate to know myself in opposition to the mendaciousness of millennia. I am not a man, I am dynamite. Would you please comment? Manisha, there is no need to comment. I am not a man, I am a dynamite. And what Nietzsche was writing did not happen in his life. He ended up in a madhouse. No crowd gathered, no disciples, no friends. His last phase of life was a tragedy. The woman he loved refused to marry him because she did not think he was in his senses. The man he respected, Wegener, a great musician, told him not to come to his house because it was Wegener's wife whom he had proposed. All friends deserted him, only his sister remained to take care of him. And finally she was also unable to take care and has to put him into a madhouse. He was certainly a man of great insights, but all those insights were only intellectual. Those great insights drove him mad because he could not manage to live with the crowd and he could not manage to live alone. He was against everything, just the way I am. But I am absolutely capable of living alone. My aloneness is absolute silence. I just come for the evening talk to be with you. Then I am alone the whole day, the whole night. But my aloneness is not lonely. My aloneness is so full of existence, so full of ecstasy and divine drunkenness. My aloneness is my innermost depth, my highest consciousness. Friedrich Nietzsche was poor in the sense that he never knew anything of meditation. So his dynamite turned against himself. He burned himself in his own intellectual, rational, logical arguments. But I am certainly not a man, I am dynamite. And my people have come already. And they are coming more and more. Millions more will be here. No boundaries of nations, no boundaries of any church can prevent them. And my whole work is to put dynamite in you, to destroy you completely so that you can enter into the cosmos with an easy heart, relaxed, at peace. finally at home. Manisha, you are right. Your feeling is right. It does not need any commentary on it. This is the right time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. After such a serious and difficult time, Sardar Gurdayal Singh has come to help you. Gilda and Gilbert, goldfish, are swimming around in their fish bowl one day, having a deep philosophical discussion. So gurgles Gilda, "You say that you do not believe in the existence of God." "That's right," bubbles Gilbert, throwing down his copy of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. And Friedrich Nietzsche says that God is dead and fish are free. "Holy shit," splutters Gilda. "Then who is the guy that changes our water?" Chester Cheese, the golf-crazed golfer, is preparing one Sunday morning to go golfing at the local golf course. "Golf, golf, golf," nags Betty Cheese, his wife, standing with her hands on her hips and colors in her hair. "That's all you ever think about. If you ever spent a weekend with me, I think I would drop dead." "Look," replies Chester, putting on his golf hat, "there is no point in trying to bribe me." Chief Patrol Officer Kowalski and his partner Officer Jabulansky are walking down Main Street in Warsaw late one night. Suddenly, Officer Kowalski stumbles over a dead body lying on the sidewalk with a huge knife in its back. Just in front of the Philharmonic Hall, "Ho!" shouts Kowalski with surprise. "What do we have to do here?" "It is a dead body, Chief," exclaims Officer Jablonski, his eyes popping out. "Right," says Kowalski, and he pulls out his pad and paper and starts writing. "Time," shouts Kowalski. "1 a.m. replies Jablonski, nervously looking at his watch. "Okay," says Kowalski, writing furiously. "Now, date is March 11th, replies Jablonski, checking his calendar book. "Good," shouts Kowalski. "Description is knife stuff in back," cries Jablonski. "Right," exclaims Kowalski. "And location?" Jablonski looks up at the huge building and says, "Is Philharmonic, Philharmonic Hall?" Kowalski scratches his head and starts writing F-I-L. "No, there is no right," he says, and then he tries again, P-I-L-L. "No, that's not it." Maybe it is F-H-I-L, shit. Snap Skovilevsky, breaking his pencil. How the hell do you spell Philharmonic? G, replies Jablonski, I don't know. Then Kovalevsky bends over, picks up the bleeding body, throws it over his shoulder, and starts walking away. Hey, chief, cries Officer Jablonski, where are you going? Kovalevsky turns around and says, let us put him in front of the post office. Never do know. Be silent. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to look inwards. Gather your energy, your total consciousness, and with an urgency, as if this is going to be your last moment in life, rush towards your very center, faster and faster, deeper and deeper. As you are coming closer to your center, a great silence descends over you. It is falling almost like soft rain, so tangible. A little more closer, and a great peace arises from your very sources, surrounds you in a glory you have never known before, in a grace that is not of this world. One step more, and you are at the very center of your being. For the first time, you are seeing your original face. As a symbol in the East, we have accepted the face of Buddha as the original face of everyone. You are facing your own hidden Buddha. This is your hidden splendor. This is your nature, your Dhamma. The Buddha has only one quality, witnessing. Witness that you are not the body. Witness that you are not the mind. Witness that you are only a witness. And suddenly you have become one with the Buddha. As your witnessing deepens, a great ecstasy starts arising in you. just as if a lotus flower is opening in the morning sun, so fresh. On its petals there is still cold dew drops of the night shining in the morning sun as pearls. At this moment you are the most fortunate people on the earth to be at your center. To be a Buddha is the greatest experience of life. To make this witnessing more deeper, Nivedana, relax, let go, but keep on witnessing. Slowly, slowly, you start melting like ice in the ocean. Of Gautam the Buddha auditorium is turning into an ocean of consciousness. 10,000 Buddhas are disappearing as separate units and are becoming the oceanic vastness, eternity, infinity. This is your ultimate nature. This is your birthright. To be a Buddha, and you have gone beyond the mind, and you have reached to the very source of your being from where you have come. And when the source and the goal become one, the circle is complete. This completion of the circle is enlightenment. Every day it will become deeper and deeper. Collect all the experiences that are happening right now. The feeling of vastness, the oceanic feeling, the great peace, the strange silence, the great ecstasy, and flowers of bliss showering on you. Collect everything. You have to bring all these things to your ordinary day-to-day life. The same grace, the same peace, the same silence, same joy, the same celebration. If you can manage to bring all these things from the center to the circumference, Buddha is bound to follow you. But anyway, persuade him. Before Nivedana calls you back, persuade the Buddha to come a little more closer, just following you, so that he remains a continuous presence behind you in every act, in every gesture, in every word, in every silence, day, night, waking, walking, sleeping, whatever you are doing, his presence is always there, following you like a shadow. But the shadow is very solid, and the shadow is very radiant. The shadow fills you with great joy. Your heart starts dancing. Nivedana, come back, but come back very peacefully, as if there is no one here, very silently, with great grace. You have to remember that you are a Buddha. Sit down just for a few seconds to remind yourself the golden path that you followed, to remind yourself all the experiences that opened their doors at the center of your being. The experience of the center is the only miracle there is. Just by your honesty, just by your sincerity, you have made this evening a magic evening. Feel the presence of Buddha behind you. These are the three steps of meditation. First, you will find Buddha as a presence behind you. Second, you will find Buddha as a presence in front of you. You will become a shadow. And third, your shadow will disappear into the Buddha. You will become the Buddha himself. You will not be anymore. Only the Buddha is. Buddha is just a symbol for pure existence, for ultimate liberation, for nirvana. One day, these three steps will be fulfilled in you. When the third step is fulfilled, you are awakened, enlightened. Then there is no birth for you, no death for you. You have become part of the ultimate cosmos. God is dead, and Zen is the only living truth.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.